that although we've come over here and that seems to be working well, we still spread out as much as we possibly can. So. All right. Well, my fourth grade Latin students this week, they asked me what my favorite Bible story was. And the two answers I gave them were both from 1 Samuel. I didn't stop to think about it. I just told them what they were, and they were both from 1 Samuel. One is in the chapter we're about to read, and the other is a little bit later. It's in 1 Samuel 14 with Jonathan and his armor bearer. They hadn't heard of either one, so I talked to them about them. Sorry? No. Something else that happens in this chapter. This chapter is just such a thoroughgoing parody of Saul before we ever learn why we should be interested in him. So why don't we read it and let's see what things we catch and then what things we'll point out along the way. This is a reminder of what we talked about last week before I erased this, right? We've been watching in this lead up and now in chapter 8 where they ask for a king. There seems to be something of a deliberate parallel between the situation with Eli near the end of his life and the present situation with Samuel, where they're setting up a dynasty, which you would expect with Eli, with the succession of the priesthood. But Samuel has, properly speaking, no right to do. And the sons of each character leave much to be desired, even though the particulars of their sins are different. So was there a procedure by which Samuel could appoint a successor judge? Not that we know of. What we see in Judges is someone seems to be raised up for a specific purpose or a specific season of deliverance. And then the next time we need a judge, what we see is the Spirit of the Lord rushes upon them. And that is what empowers them to execute their office. The only other time we see a judge trying to set up some kind of successor is with Gideon, right? Who denies the title of king and says, I won't rule over you. The Lord rules over you, which I think is a comment in conversation with the refrain, right? In those days, there was no king in Israel. But then he goes and names his son, my father is king, right? Abimelech. So.
Mm-hmm. But there's no hint in Scripture that I'm able to find where there's any even slight disapproval by God of Samuel.
I do think there is some criticism of Samuel in chapter 8 in the way the narrator phrases things. It's not overt, and I'm with you on that. There's not, I think, overt criticism of Samuel. I think there's definite grumbling on the part of the people. For sure. But I do think the narrator gives us something of God's view, and it's very subtle. But the difference between the grumbling of the people, Samuel's reaction, and then what God says in response, right? So if we go back to, I think it's in verses 4 to 9 of chapter 8, they're grumbling. The elders come. They say, behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And we don't get Samuel's internal thoughts there more than beyond just it displeasing them. But the specific note that displeases him is, give us a king to judge us. Samuel being the one. Yeah, but what's highlighted by the narrator, right, and that's one thing that's important to pay attention to in Old Testament narrative. The difference between what the narrator describes and what a character reports. Sometimes they're the same. Sometimes they're different. Sometimes they're worlds apart. And that's usually the narrator's hint at what's going on. So their complaint is this long, right? But what the narrator says displeases Samuel is very specific and is very narrow. And he quotes that at the there in the middle of verse 6, give us a king to judge us, right? So it doesn't seem to be the like all the nations or the complaint about his sons that specifically bothers Samuel, but the very specific request, give us a king to judge us. That's a little bit ambiguous. What is it about that that bothers Samuel? Right? But remember, as in the present situation, Samuel is the one who judges them. That's his job. So that I can see why that would rub Samuel the wrong way. And then we see the Lord saying to Samuel in his response in verse 7, obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's as overt as it gets, but there does seem to be implicit in that Samuel feels rejected by the people. And that is at least part of the nature of his response here.
Yeah. One of the things that, I mean, I've done a lot of reading because this has really bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like the sons were judges 50 miles away from Samuel.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is one of the differences we pointed out last week. Right, Samuel's sons and Eli's sons, there's a similarity in that they both seem to turn out rotten, as it were. But Eli's sons ministered under his thumb, as it were, or could have been under his thumb and weren't, and that was part of the problem. Yeah. And Samuel's sons, although they turn out to have similar traits, they're ministering, right? Samuel's in central Israelite territory and his sons are all the way to the south, to the extreme south. So there is a significant difference there.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what's going on with Samuel and Eli, right? There's overt, explicit, twice delivered through the mouth of a prophet criticism of Eli, accompanied by oracles of doom, right? And the situation with Samuel has parallels, but is also very distinct. And it's not accompanied with this pronouncement of destruction, although Samuel in his role also would not or should not have expected any kind of implicit continuing nature to his office passed down through his sons.
So.
Yeah, so is this a criticism of Samuel or not? But more.
I do wonder if the narrator making a point of saying that Samuel's sons are not being faithful, if that perhaps is meant to remind us of Eli and meant to be a little bit of a criticism, perhaps. But then again,
yeah. So I do think there are similarities and differences that the narrator puts in place on purpose. And I don't think it's without criticism of Samuel, although it's of a much milder character. But I think the larger part of what it's doing is pointing out that there's still a need for something like the office of a king. Samuel's not going to live forever. his sons are clearly not fit to take over the role that Samuel has. We shouldn't expect that they do either, because his role is different in nature than Eli's. But we also, even if we were tempted to go that direction, they're clearly not fit to take on this role. And Samuel's not going to live forever. So I do think there's a very mild criticism of Samuel there.
But don't you suspect that Samuel probably knew that the king was in the Lord's plan, but that the people were getting ahead of that? And
yeah, well, clearly the Lord knows and plans for a king. And I would think Samuel was aware of that. Why is he displeased here? So
my theory is that because they wanted to be like the nations, which is a theme as well.
I would be tempted to go that direction too, that what irks Samuel is that they want to be like the nations, except that when the narrator, immediately following what the elders have expressly said, he quotes the elders with regard to what bothers Samuel and does not include that part. And that's the narrator's choice to communicate to us what it is that displeases Samuel. It's not Samuel dissembling or cloaking what bothers him, right? That's the narrator giving us a window into Samuel's thinking. Right, so that makes me think it's, although you would expect that it's the being like all the nations that would bother him, and that certainly comes out in other places, his initial irritation or displeasure does not seem to be linked to that. So, Tony.
The last verse in chapter 8.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Each man goes to his city.
Yeah.
Does Samuel add something to that? I mean, oftentimes you look at the Garden of Eden, by the time they went from, you know, this is what the Lord said to Adam, then it went to Eve, and of course, you know, Satan, you know, they all added to what the Lord commanded.
Mm-hmm. So for the sake of the recording, at the end of chapter 8, Tony's pointing out, the Lord said to Samuel, obey their voice and make them a king. And what Samuel does immediately following that is Samuel then said to the men of Israel, go every man to his city. Well, the elders are there. They're with him. The command is to give them a king, but that's not what Samuel immediately does. And so that leaves us wondering. Yeah. Is that because the Lord's command was actually a paragraph long and we just get a summary and it involves this process of sending everybody home, or is it because, like, yeah, it's, you know, it's Samuel riding the brakes. Yeah, as far as we know. Yeah. Yeah. All sorts of ways to read that, and this is part of what is so interesting about Old Testament narrative. We are better readers than we think we are. We're much better readers than we give ourselves credit for. But much of the literature that we read is, or the literature we watch, right? We can think about television shows and movies actually as a similar kind of medium. Storytelling that communicates things. And we're much better at reading that kind of thing than we think we are. But what's different about Old Testament narrative and what takes some getting used to is it's very sparse. Right? We would expect things to be much more explicit in terms of the kinds of storytelling we're used to interacting with. And here there's a lot that's not said. And sometimes that leaves it open to interpretation. Like, how do we understand Samuel's actions here? Is this what he should do? Or is this Samuel hesitant to obey and drawing out the process? The narrator doesn't tell us. But what we do get is more narration. And so I think things like that would emerge from looking at the whole cycle, perhaps, instead of here from looking specifically at the end of chapter 8.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't think so. So the sacrifice in chapter 9, yeah, the portion that's held back, is that kind of an echo of Eli and his sons here? I don't think so. I think it's just a special portion that's reserved for a guest who Samuel's anticipating because of things going on behind the scenes that are not reported. Maybe more of what the Lord says to Samuel back at the very end of chapter 8, or in the interim. Yeah. But that's a good question. So, let's jump into chapter 9. I love this chapter, and it's not about the donkeys, but it also is. It is about the donkeys. We'll talk about that as we work through. There was a man of Benjamin. His name was Kish, son of Abiel, son of Deror, son of Bechorath, son of Aphiah, a Benjaminite. Sorry, I'm dropping syllables. A man of wealth. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. Remember this description of Saul, by the way, as we keep working our way through Samuel. It's important. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, were lost. So Kish said to Saul, his son, "Take one of the young men with you and arise. Go and look for the donkeys." And he passed through the hill country of Ephraim and passed through the land of Shalishah, but did not find them. And they passed through the land of Sha'alim, but they were not there. Then they passed through the land of Benjamin, but did not find them. When they came to the land of Zuf, Saul said to his servant who was with him, "Come, let us go back, lest my father cease to care about the donkeys and become anxious about us." But he said to him, "Behold, there is a man of God in this city, and he is a man who is held in honor. All that he says comes true. So now let us go there. Perhaps he can tell us the way we should go." And as Tony pointed out, right, it's interesting that the man of God is anonymous at this point. We probably suspect he's Samuel, but the text doesn't tell us that. And these two don't mention him by name. So verse 7, "Then Saul said to his servant, 'But if we go, what can we bring the man? For the bread in our sacks is gone, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have?' The servant answered Saul again, 'Here, I have with me a quarter of a shekel of silver, and I will give it to the man of God to tell us our way.' Formerly in Israel, when a man went to inquire of God, he said, 'Come, let us go to the seer,' for today's prophet was formerly called a seer. And Saul said to his servant, 'Well said, come, let us go.' So they went to the city where the man of God was." Pause there for a moment. What are some things you notice in what we just read? They are. They're paying to inquire. Now, it's described as a gift, but, I mean, I would put gift in scare quotes there. But that does seem to be the regular process. The way that's described doesn't seem to describe anything unusual. You go to inquire of God, and when you do, you bring an offering. And like with the priests, when you bring your offering, a portion of that offering goes to the priests. So that does strike us as weird, but I don't think it's out of the ordinary.
I'm going to guess that's probably pretty common all across the
Yeah. Well, and when Naaman the Syrian comes. Yeah. Yes. So, for example, when we see Naaman the Syrian come to Israel to be healed of his leprosy, he anticipates and has brought with him things to give to, I think it's Elisha, who refuses it, right? And then Gehazi goes after him to get it, and then he gets Naaman's leprosy. But there does seem to be that expectation. That does seem to be normal procedure. Yes, I find that very interesting as we read this passage. It's noted that the family from which Saul comes is very wealthy. And they've gone on this rather lengthy journey through Israel trying to find these donkeys. And Saul, this handsome young man belonging to this wealthy family, has no resources. Yeah, or he's gone through them. But the servant with him does. He has what they need. Saul doesn't have what they need. But the servant does. I think that's very interesting. Yes. Yeah. We'll get to that. Mention that again. The contrast between the narrator's description of the family of Kish and Saul's own self-description later. Yeah. Verse 11. I think it's my favorite part of this chapter. As they went up the hill to the city, they met young women coming out to draw water and said to them, "Is the seer here?" They answered, "He is. Behold, he is just ahead of you. Hurry. He has come just now to the city because the people have a sacrifice today on the high place. As soon as you enter the city, you will find him before he goes up to the high place to eat. For the people will not eat till he comes, since he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those who are invited will eat. Now go up, for you will meet him immediately." So they went up to the city. As they were entering the city, they saw Samuel coming out toward him on his way up to the high place. What do you notice there? Why is there a high place? The high place, until or without a central sanctuary, the high place is the natural place to go up and offer sacrifices and worship. Once Solomon's temple is established, right, then the use of the high places instead of Solomon's temple becomes a critique of the Davidic kings, that they worship at the high places instead of the temple. There was, yeah, so there was a central sanctuary at Shiloh, but then the ark leaves, goes on its campaign against the Philistines, it comes back. It's now at Kiriath Jearim, but there doesn't, without a permanent temple, there seems to be a great deal of latitude in what's allowed in terms of place of worship for the Israelites. After the building of the temple, that latitude goes away. But yeah. Yeah, and Samuel's there. So that doesn't seem to be something that's out of order at this time in Israelite worship. But what else do you notice? So there's a high place. There's going to be probably a sacrifice and feast together at the high place. But there's something else. He's telling them to hurry. Or they are telling him to hurry. Who's the they that tell him to hurry? The young women at a well. Do you notice that? Why this paragraph begins with they met young women coming out to draw water. Right, the beautiful music swells. This is a rich young man from whom we expect great things on this quest to find something who meets a flock of young ladies, right? We have an eligible bachelor. We have several eligible young women. There's a well because they're going out to draw water. There's going to be a wedding! Never mind. He's in there. Go. Hurry. Right. The narrator introduces a familiar kind of scene, right? And we know what's coming and we know what to expect. And as listeners, we start to get excited, right? Because this man whose name means asked, who's introduced right after a chapter where they ask for someone, right? Obviously, this must be the guy who's going to be king, right? We're not quite to where we get that confirmed yet, but this would be part of that, that this young man gets a wife as part of coming to the realization that he's going to be anointed king, and instead, nothing. Nothing. He needed directions. What we do get is a man asking directions, or at least getting directions. That's unusual, right? But what we don't get, what we're set up for and then deliberately frustrated by the narrator, right? We're set up to expect a wedding and then completely taken out from under us. That's not incidental. It's very easy to miss, but that is not at all incidental. The narrator didn't have to tell us that this was a group of young women. Certainly didn't have to tell us that they're on their way to draw water. That's completely gratuitous. Except that. In this chapter, where the previous chapter, the name of the character, the situation going on, everything is building toward something incredibly momentous. In the midst of that, we have something that just immediately deflates us. He's setting up these huge expectations for Saul and what Saul means for the nation. And then, the significant kind of, a letdown in the middle of this chapter that introduces him. Let's keep reading. It's an inversion of this type scene that we see with Isaac, we see with Jacob, we see with Moses, we see with Jesus. And we see it deliberately put on its head with Saul. Well, but what happens at the end of that chapter? Right? Because John is drawing on this familiar type scene, but not using it in the way we expect. Right? Because we meet a woman who, as it turns out, is not eligible. Right? She's had 5 husbands, and she's now with someone who's not her husband. But what happens at the end of that chapter? Right? That woman and the whole region come to know Jesus because of that interaction at the well. So there, it's a familiar scene, used in a weird way, but the fulfillment is above and beyond and so much more than just Jesus getting a wife. And here, it's the opposite. It's everything leads us to expect something that doesn't happen at all. I think what we see here is the narrator giving us a little hint that our expectations for Saul are going to come up short. Because what we have coming out of chapter 8 and into chapter 9 is this expectation that this one we meet is going to fulfill all of the expectations for Israel and their need for a king. And we have here in this little fleeting moment in the midst of that, something that tells us, nope. Yes. Both their need for a king and their desire for a king. Both of those things will be frustrated. Both of those things. So, verse 15. And here we get some information about why Samuel was prepared for this, right? Now the day before Saul came, the Lord had revealed to Samuel, "Tomorrow about this time I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be prince over my people Israel. He shall save my people from the hand of the Philistines. For I have seen my people because their cry has come to me." When Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, "Here is the man of whom I spoke to you. He it is who shall restrain my people." Then Saul approached Samuel in the gate and said, "Tell me, where is the house of the seer?" Samuel answered Saul, "I am the seer. Go up before me to the high place, for today you shall eat with me, and in the morning I will let you go and will tell you all that is on your mind. As for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them, for they have been found. And for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for all your father's house?" Saul answered, "Am I not a Benjaminite from the least of the tribes of Israel? And is not my clan the humblest of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then have you spoken to me in this way?" We'll come back and talk about that. Then Samuel took Saul and his young man and brought them into the hall and gave them a place at the head of those who had been invited, who were about 30 persons. And Samuel said to the cook, "Bring the portion I gave you, of which I said to you, put it aside." So the cook took up the leg and what was on it and set them before Saul. And Samuel said, "See, what was kept is set before you. Eat, because it was kept for you until the hour appointed, that you might eat with the guests." So Saul ate with Samuel that day. And when they came down from the high place into the city, a bed was spread for Saul on the roof, and he lay down to sleep. Then at the break of dawn, Samuel called to Saul on the roof, "Up, that I may send you on your way." So Saul arose, and both he and Samuel went out into the street. As they were going down to the outskirts of the city, Samuel said to Saul, "Tell the servant to pass on before us, and when he has passed on, stop here yourself for a while, that I may make known to you the word of God." And then we should probably keep reading, but we'll pause there for a moment. What are some things you notice in that section? Two things. One was mentioned earlier. Something else going on as well. Yes. Yeah. So what's going on with Saul's description of his status and where he comes from and the way that is marked out in comparison to the narrator? At the beginning of the chapter, right, the narrator had said, "There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, son of Zeror, son of Bechorath, son of Aphiah, a Benjaminite, a man of wealth." And then it goes on to describe Saul in particular as handsome and tall, probably dark as well. Right? Tall, dark, and handsome. Yeah, so is this merely like self-deprecation and trying to get out of what seems like heavy responsibility? I think there are two things going on. Saul's family, his specific family within Benjamin, is very wealthy. And so that's part of what the narrator describes. But what's Benjamin like coming out of the book of Judges? What happens to Benjamin at the end of the book of Judges? They're almost wiped out in a civil war between the tribes, right? Because of Gibeah, right? Gibeah of Benjamin and their behavior toward guests, right? The particular way that they failed to show hospitality to the stranger, there's much more to it than that, but that is very much a part of what's wrong in Gibeah. And then the response of Benjamin, instead of joining with Israel to punish this town, they rally around Gibeah and fight against their brothers. And almost the entire tribe is wiped out. So there is something to what Saul says. He doesn't mention his own particular family. He does mention his clan, but that's a much broader, much larger unit within the tribe of Benjamin. I don't know how much time has elapsed since the civil war with Benjamin. So, but it would have taken them a long time to recover. Yeah, so what he says about Benjamin is true up to a point, although he's carefully avoiding saying anything about his own family. Right? Am I not a Benjaminite from the least of the tribes of Israel? And is not my clan the humblest of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? That may be fudging it a bit. Certainly his own family is very prominent within his clan and within his tribe. So there does seem to be that kind of backpedaling. And perhaps it's amazement that this might be said to him, or perhaps it's trying to wriggle out of responsibility. But there's something else that's worth noting earlier in the passage that we just read. What does the servant say about the man of God in this city? Back in verse 6. Yeah, he's held in honor. All that he says comes to the implication of what the servant says would seem to be that this is a very famous and well-known man of God. Right? He's known in Israel. We know from earlier that Samuel makes a regular circuit through the central part of Israel. He would not be an unknown person. But what happens? Verse 14, they see Samuel coming out toward them. What happens in verse 18? Saul walks up and talks to him face to face and has no idea who he is. So think about what we've seen from Saul so far over the course of this chapter. He's introduced as one we would expect great things from. Right? Remember, his name means asked or asked for. Right? He's a man of wealth. He's tall, dark, and handsome. Right? He's an eligible young bachelor, but he can't find his father's donkeys. His wallet's empty. He's a man of wealth, but his wallet's empty. He's dependent on his servant to know where to go and what to do, and to have the resources to do it. This expectation of a wedding and things that follow from that is frustrated as soon as it's introduced. He meets this famous man of God face to face and has no idea who he is. And when the man of God tells him wonderful and amazing things, his response, we're not entirely sure the nature of his response, except that we can definitely say he doesn't welcome what the man of God says to him. We got all from the moment he's introduced. We have lots of question marks hanging over this young man on whom such great expectations are set. Let's keep reading. Because this really continues at least halfway into chapter 10. And we do have 8 minutes to go. Then Samuel, chapter 10, verse 1. Then Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on his head and kissed him and said, "Has not the Lord anointed you to be prince over his people Israel? And you shall reign over the people of the Lord, and you will save them from the hand of their surrounding enemies. And this shall be the sign to you that the Lord has anointed you to be prince over his heritage. When you depart from me today, you will meet two men by Rachel's tomb in the territory of Benjamin at Zelzah. And they will say to you, 'The donkeys that you went to seek are found. And now your father has ceased to care about the donkeys and is anxious about you, saying, "What shall I do about my son?" Then you shall go on from there farther and come to the oak of Tabor. Three men going up to God at Bethel will meet you there, one carrying three young goats, another carrying three loaves of bread, and another carrying a skin of wine. And they will greet you and give you two loaves of bread, which you shall accept from their hand. After that, you shall come to Gibeath Elohim, where there is a garrison of the Philistines. And there, as soon as you come to the city, you will meet a group of prophets coming down from the high place with the harp, tambourine, flute, and lyre before them, prophesying. Then the Spirit of the Lord will rush upon you, and you will prophesy with them, and you will be turned into another man. Now when these signs meet you, do what your hand finds to do, for God is with you. Then go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I am coming down to you to offer burnt offerings and to sacrifice peace offerings. 7 days you shall wait until I come to you and show you what you shall do." Those instructions are important and they're picked up again in chapter 13. When he turned his back to leave Samuel, God gave him another heart, and all these signs came to pass that day. When they came to Gibeah, behold, a group of prophets met him. And the Spirit of God rushed upon him, and he prophesied among them. And when all who knew him previously saw how he prophesied with the prophets, the people said to one another, "What has come over the son of Kish? Is Saul also among the prophets?" And a man of the place answered, "And who is their father?" Therefore it became a proverb, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" And when he had finished prophesying, he came to the high place. Saul's uncle said to him and to his servants, "Where did you go?" And he said, "To seek the donkeys." And when we saw they were not to be found, we went to Samuel. Now he's named by them instead of called the man of God. And Saul's uncle said, "Please tell me what Samuel said to you. He seems to know who Samuel is, right?" And Saul said to his uncle, "He told us plainly that the donkeys had been found. But about the matter of the kingdom of which Samuel had spoken, he did not tell him anything." That's weird. Now, Samuel called the people of Israel together to the Lord at Mizpah. And he said to the people of Israel, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt, and I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you. But today you have rejected your God, who saves you from all your calamities and your distresses. And you have said to him, 'Set a king over us.' Now therefore present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your thousands." Then Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. He brought the tribe of Benjamin near by its clans, and the clan of the Matrites was taken by lot. And Saul, the son of Kish, was taken by lot. But when they sought him, he could not be found. So they inquired again of the Lord, "Is there a man still to come?" And the Lord said, "Behold, he has hidden himself among the baggage." Then they ran and took him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. It's the second time his height has been specifically mentioned. And Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? There is none like him among all the people." And all the people shouted, "Long live the king." Then Samuel told the people the rights and duties of the kingship. and he wrote them in a book and laid it up before the Lord. Then Samuel sent all the people away, each one to his home. Saul also went to his home at Gibeah. And with him went men of valor whose hearts God had touched. But some worthless fellows said, "How can this man save us?" And they despised him and brought him no present. But he held his peace. What do you notice there? I think you're commenting the same thing. Yeah, he's reluctant. Okay. So two things. One, he's reluctant to take this on. The tallest man in Israel is hiding among the baggage. I think that should cause us to chuckle, right? Like, he's not going to be able to fit in there without a hand sticking out there or a foot sticking out there, right? Or his head sticking up above the wagon. Maybe he's got his eyes closed, right? If I can't see you, you can't see me. He's reluctant to take on the office. There's a parody of his height becomes something of an element of humor with the description of him hiding. But then after all of this, yeah, everybody goes home. We're again set up where it's carrying forward this idea of great expectations that's met with, but also, and this is the last thing I'll point out, we got about 30 seconds left. Where is his home? His home is Gibeah, the town in which those things went down at the end of Judges. The town that is responsible for the civil war that resulted in the entire tribe of Benjamin almost being blotted out. That's where our king is from. So great, wonderful, and amazing things are happening for Israel, who wants a king and has now been granted one. But from the very outset, dark shadows are cast over Saul's kingship. Why would God do this? Why would God give them this king that frustrates their expectations? It's a good question. I'm not going to answer it. Let's keep reading. We'll see you next week.